We have one case this morning. However, before we proceed with oral argument, my colleagues and I wish to pause and pay tribute to a true giant in the field of military law, Army Colonel retired Fran Gilligan. Fran passed away in July. Fran served with great distinction in this court. He was the senior legal advisor to then-judge and Chief Judge Susan Crawford for 15 years. Before that, Fran had a remarkable career with the Army Judge Advocate General's Corps for 27 years, retiring as a Colonel 06. While in the JAG Corps, Fran served in an impressive array of assignments too numerous to mention with specificity here. Suffice it to say that he served as a trial counsel, defense counsel, appellate counsel, staff judge advocate, military judge, instructor, academic director, chairman of the Joint Service Committee, and the Army's chief trial judge. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that Fran served in Vietnam in the largest general court martial jurisdiction, where at one point they had pending 140 general courts martial. During his time on active duty, Fran was awarded 3 Legion of Merit awards and 2 Bronze Stars. In 2006, Fran joined the Office of Military Commissions and served in that important role until his passing. Indeed, during the course of his entire career, Fran was universally known as a true military justice expert. In addition to his extraordinary accomplishments, Fran was also a prolific author. He wrote 15 books, more than 40 articles, and numerous Army publications on criminal law, evidence, and related topics. You would be hard-pressed to go into any military justice practitioner's office around the globe and not find a copy of Fran's tome, Court-Martial Procedure, which he co-authored with Fran Lederer. But perhaps Fran's greatest professional legacy involves his role as a mentor and teacher to generations of students. Starting all the way back in 1970, Fran taught at the Army JAG School, the Army War College, the University of Maryland, Jacksonville State, Austin Peay State, Catholic University, and notably as an adjunct professor at the George Washington University School of Law for the past 32 years. It is no exaggeration to say that the number of grateful law students, lawyers, and judges whom Fran guided, trained, enlightened, and instructed during more than 50 years would fill this courtroom many times over. And when reminiscing about Fran, his colleagues, friends, and students, without exception, would extol his integrity, his commitment to excellence, and his dedication to the rule of law. Fran leaves behind his wife, Barbara, 2 daughters, 4 grandchildren, and numerous great-grandchildren. Fran will be greatly and deeply missed. However, his example of a life well lived, of faithful service to this nation, and as an inspiration to us all, will endure. We ask that you keep Colonel Gilligan and his family in your thoughts. Thank you. Our case today is United States versus Saul. Captain Bruzek, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
Major Barros, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well. Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Captain Michael James Bruzek, and I here this morning together with my co-counsel, Ms. Megan Morenos. We represent the appellant, Staff Sergeant Thomas M. Saul. Your Honor, before proceeding, respectfully request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. Staff Sergeant Saul's guilty plea for willful destruction of property was improvident where Staff Sergeant Saul on three occasions denied having any intent to destroy the property and was in fact surprised that the property had been destroyed. Accordingly, this court should set aside the finding of guilty and should do so for three reasons. First, that the military judge relied on improper inferences in an attempt to overcome Staff Sergeant Saul's steadfast denial of intent. Second, that the factual basis provided by Staff Sergeant Saul was insufficient to show willfulness. And finally, that the military judge's follow-up questions were insufficient to overcome Staff Sergeant Saul's steadfast denial.
Captain Brzezik, the
yes,
wording of the question presented is very fact-focused.
Yes, sir.
And your brief is as well, and that's understandable. That's all well and good. But I'm particularly interested in the legal principles at play here and the precedent that this court might set when deciding this case. So my initial question to you is, in your view, in a guilty plea case, when may a court invoke the permissible inference doctrine to address any deficiencies that may have arisen in the course of the care inquiry?
Your Honor, it would depend on the extent to which that inconsistency is manifest in the providence inquiry. So what's crucial in this case is it's not just some misunderstanding of words or some misunderstanding of terms that lawyers may use versus non-lawyers. It's a wholesale steadfast denial of one of the elements of the offense. And so that being so, what the military judge had to do was get to a point where Staff Sergeant Saul may have admitted the element, essentially going back on this denial that he had. So in terms of inferences, inferences may be employed on certain occasions to the extent they validate those admissions which are already made on the record. And that fits squarely within the principles of Article 45. Article 45 calls for consistency. And when faced with an inconsistency, the judge has only two choices. The first is to either resolve that inconsistency, or such as was the case here where that inconsistency can't be resolved, the guilty plea has to be rejected. And so there may be situations where an inference can be employed if, for example, there's some misunderstanding in the words or something of that nature, but that's not the case that is before the court here today.
So let's say that we have a case where the elements are correctly described, the accused admits to it, but in the course of discussion, the colloquy with the military judge, the accused does not address, let's say in this instance, does not address the issue of mens rea.
Yes, sir.
Can an inference be invoked there or not under your approach to this issue?
That may be a situation in which the military judge could do that, to the extent that the specific question isn't actually brought up, it's not answered. But I would caveat this by saying that under United States versus CARE, those elements have to be articulated. For the accused to knowingly and intelligently enter a plea of guilty, it has to be shown on the record that they understand the elements. So if there's no discussion of mens rea that comes up, that's going to befall United States versus CARE, and that's going to run against Article 45. This being the case.
Counsel, I have a follow-up question on that. Is it consistent with the discussion of Rule 910E for there ever to be a permissible inference? I mean, when the rule says, before the plea is accepted, the accused must admit every element of the offense to which the accused pleaded guilty, does that leave room for any permissible inferences, or do we need the accused to admit every element of the offense?
Your Honor, the accused does need to admit every element of the offense. Permissive inferences may support those explicit admissions that the accused does make. But in the instance where an accused denies an element, this is tantamount to a declaration of innocence. And so what the judge is doing is essentially engaging in sort of a factual sufficiency inquiry, and that's not the point of a providence inquiry. That's not what Article 45 calls for. What happened here is that the military judge is circumstantially drawing on these facts, but these facts are open to interpretation. These facts could be interpreted to suggest that the mental state was there, or they could be interpreted to suggest that the mental state was not there. That being the case, should the military judge use circumstantial evidence in that matter and draw inferences, what they are doing is going up against the necessity that the accused knowingly and intelligently enter a plea of guilty, knowing and intelligently understand the elements. And so, being that the Staff Sergeant Saul essentially proclaimed innocence, he denied this element, it wasn't enough for the military judge to interpret the facts in that manner. What we're looking at is a sort of analysis that a trier in fact may do at trial, but it's a very different context when you're dealing with a guilty plea. And that's what Article 45 calls for. This is a congressional mandate designed to protect service members when they're entering a plea of guilty. It's to ensure justice when these guilty pleas are entered, because it is a great injustice when an individual pleads guilty to something, that guilty plea is accepted, and they do not in fact believe that they are guilty of that offense. And that's what was the case here. This being so, I want to return to the issue of the extent to which facts are, which are open to interpretation, cannot be relied upon in the event that the accused denies the element. And the reason for that being, like I mentioned, is the necessity of ensuring a knowing and intelligent plea of guilty. In the military, we have a very different context than what may be present in the civilian world. It's a system in which service members are a part of a culture in which they follow orders, and oftentimes when faced with disciplinary action, they may feel some sense of coercion in order to plea, some sense of coercion that guides them to plead guilty. That's what this process is designed to protect against. And here, Staff Sergeant Saul, he denied having intent to destroy the windshield. It's not just that he denied it, but these other circumstantial facts, they strongly suggest that he genuinely did not expect that this was the outcome. This being so, the factual basis that Staff Sergeant Saul provided did not establish the element of willfulness. And willfulness is, per United States versus Bernanke, which this court's predecessor articulated, it is an actual intent to produce the result charged. The government chose to charge Staff Sergeant Saul with willful destruction of property. They didn't charge him with some other offense that would have had a lower mental state. They charged him specifically with willful destruction of property. Now, the military judge, it was incumbent upon him to instruct Staff Sergeant Saul as to what that meant, willfulness. I would submit to the court that to that end, the benchmark instruction was not terribly helpful. It says willfulness is with intent or purpose. And so we have this term willfulness, which itself in sort of regular usage doesn't lead itself to a firm definition, and then intent also kind of has an absence of this firm definition. Same with purpose to a certain extent. Now, United States versus CARE called on the service courts to employ more exacting definitions when engaging in a providence inquiry. And this is a very prime example of where a failure to that end has taken place. What the military judge should have done is instructed Staff Sergeant Saul, saying, this is what willfulness is. It's an actual intent to destroy the property. Here are some of the facts that you have provided. Here's this fact. Here's this fact. Here's this fact. Now, previously, you said you did not intend to destroy the windshield. Based on how I have defined the law to you and based on these facts, does that change your perspective?
So, counsel, I think the government will get up and tell us that that's exactly what the military judge did here. The military judge looked at the law and said, well, it's enough, at least in a contested case, that you can infer intent if it's the natural and probable consequence of a voluntary act. And then the military judge asked a whole bunch of questions to establish that the breaking of the windshield was a natural consequence of a voluntary act. And then the government says that's enough, what you just described the military judge needed to do, the military judge did in this case. So what would your rebuttal to that be? Why is that not enough?
Your Honor, the military judge's focus was on natural and probable consequences. Now, if we're talking about willfulness, that only gets partway there with regard to the definition. What had to be established on the record is that Staff Sergeant Saul specifically intended the consequences of his actions. Now, he appeared to admit that he did intend to strike the windshield, but when we're dealing with specific intent, this is the highest level of mental culpability that has to be established. And that is not shown here because while natural and probable consequences may have been at play with regard to the destruction of the windshield, and while there were other circumstances and things of that nature, Article 45 calls for consistency. It doesn't call for reasonable interpretations. It doesn't call for specific facts which can overcome the inconsistency. It calls for the accused to intelligently and knowingly be able to enter the plea by understanding the elements. So the military judge didn't give an appropriate instruction as to what specific intent was. Now, understanding United States versus Bernanke, there's discussion about context being what drives the definition of willfulness. But the underlying principle is always that there has to be a specific intent. That's the question that the military judge had asked Staff Sergeant Saul, and he didn't do that. He essentially engaged in a factual sufficiency analysis, employing the things, as Your Honor has referred to as something that may happen in a contested matter. But the purpose of Article 45 isn't to establish those bare facts that may support a finding of guilty at trial. It's to have a consistent inquiry from the accused to show that they can knowingly and intelligently enter the plea of guilty, and that's not what happened here.
So why, from your perspective, doesn't Article 45 control the disposition of this case without the need for this court to get into the issue of when a permissible inference may be invoked in a guilty plea? My point being, you seem to be arguing in your briefs and now that based on the responses provided by the accused, that it set up a matter inconsistent with the guilty plea. So why isn't it full stop right there, 45A problem?
Well, Your Honor, Article 45, it gives two options. It doesn't require that the guilty plea be automatically rejected when an inconsistent matter is raised. It requires that that inconsistent matter be resolved. Now, the inconsistency that Staff Sergeant's...
From your perspective, was that resolved here?
No, Your Honor. And it was not resolved because that level of inconsistency is the highest level of inconsistency that an accused can present during a Providence inquiry. It's a wholesale denial of one of the elements. It's not a question of him misunderstanding intent or something of that nature or perhaps speaking inartfully. He flat out said on three occasions, I did not intend to destroy the windshield. That level of inconsistency requires a resolution of equal or greater magnitude, which is not what the military judge did here. The military judge relied on circumstantial evidence. He relied on an incomplete definition of willfulness, and from this he pieced together something, never mind the fact that Staff Sergeant Saul never once went back on his denial of intent. At no point does he admit that he had intent. At no point after the discussion with the military judge did he reconsider and say, well, now that I understand that definition, I guess I did have an intent. It just didn't happen. And so, yes, Your Honor, this does fall squarely within Article 45. And being that the Staff Sergeant Saul did not present facts which resolve that inconsistency, the military judge had to reject the guilty plea. That was the only outcome that Article 45 could yield at that point.
Captain Brusick, it's still not clear to me why in this case, or maybe in any case from your point of view, that the inference that was taken in this case should not be allowed. In other words, I thought the idea in a guilty plea is that the accused is explaining to the judge what his conduct is and what he wants to plead guilty to. And the judge is supposed to say, all right, here's the law regarding that. And if an inconsistency like this arises, then here's the law, accused, that resolves what you've just told me. And do you still want to plead guilty? And I guess I'm still not clear to me why you don't think the inference could be properly taken in this case. I know you've said it a couple of times. And it could be me now, and not you. But can you just square that with me one more time here?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. I begin with the principle that an accused should not be found guilty during a Providence inquiry if they proclaim innocence. One avenue by which a proclamation of innocence may take place is if they deny one of the elements. Now, Article 45 calls for consistency, and even if there may be some facts which tend to support the guilty plea, if that inconsistency isn't resolved under Article 45, it has to be rejected.
So your claim is that the judge explaining to him with counsel, I think, about this inference that kind of bridges the problem he raised with regard to his intent to damage the property. Your position is that you just can't get there based on what he said? In other words, the judge is saying, here's the law, accused, regarding the inconsistency you just raised. Do you agree that your conduct fits within that legal framework? I mean, do you agree that characterizes the conduct that you're trying to plead guilty to here? And he says yes. But you're saying you can't make that jump.
In this case, no, Your Honor, because the discussion between the military judge and Staff Sergeant Saul was essentially parked at this notion of natural and probable consequences. That's an incomplete definition of willfulness. Second,
incomplete because?
Because, Your Honor, it does not address the specific intent. And the question isn't what the natural and probable consequences are. It's what Staff Sergeant Saul's attitude towards those natural and probable consequences were. If that was what he actually intended by his actions, and that's what he was willing to admit to, that may have established the element. But in terms of the inferences...
What might he have said, from your viewpoint, to satisfy the complaint that you have now?
Yes, Your Honor, what he could have said is...
He being the accused.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Staff Sergeant Saul, what he could have said was, understanding now, as you have explained the law to me and the facts as you have explained them to me that I have admitted to, on reconsideration, now it appears to me I did intend. If he said that, we wouldn't be in this situation right now. And to return to the earlier issue that you're inquiring about, Your Honor, the problem with the inference is that it remains open to interpretation. And a lot of the discussion, we've talked about permissive inferences. Part of the purpose of the plea inquiry is to extinguish the possibility that the accused had at most a lesser mental state, which would not have established the crime that he had been charged of. In this case, the facts were open to an interpretation. They didn't lead to a necessary inference that he did intend to destroy the windshield. To the contrary, he denied that he intended to. And understanding that there is a high level where the facts are what guide this question, it's conceivable that he could have hit the windshield and it would have been accidental. Had this gone to trial, a jury could have come to that determination. And, Your Honor, with that, I can see that my time is up. May I briefly conclude?
Let me first ask my colleagues if there are any questions from the bench. Seeing none, please conclude briefly.
Thank you, Your Honor. Based on the foregoing arguments, respectfully ask that Staff Sergeant Saul's conviction be set aside. Thank you.
Thank you, Captain Brusick. Major Barris.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court, I am Major Vanessa Barros, and along with my co-counsel, Ms. Mary Ellen Payne, we represent the United States. The military judge did not abuse his discretion in finding appellant's plea of guilty provident. The military judge here applied a well-established principle that specific intent, such as willfulness, can be inferred by the natural and probable consequences of an accused's voluntary act. Therefore, this court should find appellant's plea provident.
Major Barros, I think it's not going to be a surprise to you, the question I'm going to pose to you, and that is, in the view of the government, in a guilty plea case, when may a court invoke the permissible inference doctrine if there are deficiencies in the course of the guilty plea?
Your Honor, going back to the principles of a guilty plea, there has to be a factual basis. And here, the appellant admitted to the voluntary act. He admitted to hitting the windshield with a large amount of force. He also admitted that he would have applied more force than the average size man, given that he was larger than the average size man. So he agreed that he would apply.
Counsel, I don't think that they're even contesting that if this had been a contested case, there would have been sufficient evidence for the permissible inference. I think we're really just squarely focused on the question of, is the permissible inference allowable in a guilty plea case, or is it not?
Yes, Your Honor, the permissive inference is allowed in a guilty plea case, and Willis is very instructive in that case. There's very similar facts here in which the appellant...
Now, you say very similar facts, but that was a transferred intent case. How are you saying that Willis in this case are similar?
It's similar because the court still used an inference to infer, to establish intent. In Willis, the appellant there stated that he did not intend to kill his uncle. Very similar to what happened in this case where they're initially denying to have the requisite intent. Yet in Willis, this court stated and use a permissive inference to then find the plea of guilty provident. But in this case,
well, Major Barris, as the Chief noted, the concept or the legal principle behind that was concurrent intent. He had the specific intent to kill someone. It's just it wasn't his uncle. And so the inference, the permissible inference, went to the fact of the means by which he attempted this homicide. And that was the whole language about the killing zone. So is that not distinguishable from the specific facts we have here, wherein the appellant never said that he had the specific intent to damage or destroy the windshield?
I understand the distinction, Your Honor. However, if you look at the language in Willis, it did say that the defendant is responsible for all natural and probable consequences of the act, regardless of the intended victim. And so this case is recognizing the permissive inference that, you know, the military judge used in this case. And the key takeaway from Willis is that an inference was used. This court upheld a guilty plea with using an inference. And so this notion
counsel,
that appellant
I take your point, but my understanding of the reason in contested cases why we allow permissible inferences is because the accused has a constitutional right not to testify. So we can't get into their mind if they choose not to testify. So we use other evidence to infer what was going on in their mind. But in a guilty plea, they've waived that right, right? And they open their mind to the military judge and to the court. And the military judge asked the accused, did you intend to do this? And he said, no. So why in this case where we don't, where we could look right into the mind of the accused and ask them whether they had the intent, which is an element of the crime, why would we then need a permissible inference to overcome what they said, what he said three times on the record?
Your Honor, I have two responses. First, I would like to point, this court to its precedent and has stated in cases that in a guilty plea case, you can consider stipulation of fact, recognizing that was not applicable in this case, but you can also look at the colloquy with the accused and any reasonable inferences drawn therefrom. So this court has recognized that you can apply inferences or look to circumstantial evidence. And even when you look at Article 109 in the President's explanation.
Now, is that at the appellate level or the trial court level in those cases that you're just citing?
At
the reasonable inferences can be drawn.
At the trial level, and that's exactly what was done in this case, the military judge made reasonable inferences.
We didn't have a trial, right? Now, normally at the trial level, we give deference to trials because we give deference to finders of facts, to panels. At the appellate level, we generally have great deference for the trial. We didn't have a trial here, right?
Correct. But again, in a guilty plea context, the military judge in finding a plea provident can make reasonable inferences. And the military judge did so in this case. And those reasonable inferences actually were admissions by the accused. He admitted to the underlying voluntary act. He admitted that he applied more force than the average person, and then he admitted that it was a natural and probable consequence. As Your Honor mentioned before, the military judge did everything he could, and we could not ask more from the military judge. He, in fact, noticed an inconsistency or a lack of understanding of the intent.
Well, isn't it possible what we could have asked him to do is to say, well, if you did not intend this crime, then I can't find you guilty of it?
That could be an option, but under this court's precedent on reliance of RCM 910H, a military judge should resolve an inconsistency, and that's exactly what was done in this case.
Counsel, on that point, how is the inconsistency resolved? I mean, let's assume that military judges can use permissible inferences, and if nothing had been said about intent, then there might not have been a conflict, but I think appellant's point is that the accused three times said, I didn't have the intent to destroy it. And then we have the statement that I knew the likely outcome. But even if we can have that permissible inference, don't we still have a conflict? Isn't it kind of like he's saying, I didn't intend and I did intend?
Your Honor, the military judge was concerned with the specific intent element throughout the colloquy. And throughout the colloquy, he's explaining the intent element to appellant. Initially, he explains intent through stating the bench book definition of willful. He then states that I'm not sure if we have purpose, if we have intent here. And then the judge went one step further and defined willfulness by using the natural and probable consequence, which the Supreme Court has stated that that is a way to define specific intent.
Now, yeah. Appellant says that if the accused had at that point said, oh, I understand now, I didn't previously understand what intent was, although I said I intended to destroy the windshield, I didn't intend to destroy the windshield, now I understand that I did, then that would have been a resolution of the inconsistency. But, of course, the accused didn't say that. So we have three statements that he didn't intend to destroy the windshield, and then we have a permissible inference. And even if we say it's allowed, we have one that says he did intend to destroy the windshield. How is the inconsistency resolved between those two things, since he never took back his other statements?
Your Honor, although appellant never took back, what is required in a guilty plea is a sufficient factual basis. And when appellant admitted that it was a natural and probable consequence that destruction would occur through his voluntary act, that created a factual basis for the military judge to find appellant's plea provident.
Let me ask it this way. Suppose he had said, I didn't intend to destroy the windshield. And the military judge said, well, wait a minute, that's a problem because you're pleading guilty. And he said, okay, I did intend to destroy the windshield. Would that be sufficient to resolve the conflict?
No, Your Honor, but that's not what happened in this case. The military judge explained what intent was. And another way to define willfulness is through the natural and probable consequences. And the military judge took the time to understand that term. He took a recess to read applicable case law. And he came back and he defined the intent element to appellant. Because it's clear from the earlier discussion between appellant and the military judge that he wasn't quite understanding the intent element. And the military judge knew that, and it raised a red flag. And then from there, the military judge then apply the applicable law, explained specific intent in a different way, which the Supreme Court has allowed. You can infer intent through the natural and probable consequences. And it was
at that. Prove intent through the natural and probable consequences.
Correct, Your Honor.
Because I was about to say, why isn't Bernanke controlling?
Your Honor, Bernanke is controlling, and the government does agree that in Bernanke that was under the recklessness standard, and you cannot infer specific intent through recklessness. But Bernanke is not applicable here. The government understands the specific intent element here is willfulness. And that is the specific intent element that the military judge understood as well. And so there's nothing in
the record.
But
the military judge arrived at specific intent. This is what the whole discussion is about. He arrived at it by virtue of the permissible inference, and that's where the question comes in, and that's what the chief asked, is that it is use of a permissible inference to bolster or conclude that there is specific intent, sufficient in a guilty plea. I mean, that's what all of us are trying are struggling with.
But this court's precedent has provided a message to the field in that you can use permissive inferences in a guilty plea. And Willis is a prime example when the accused contradicted
Besides
an element
Besides Willis,
of
what other cases do you have from this court supporting that?
I mean, from this court specifically? I can provide a supplemental citation, but there is a case, Adams 73MJ223, in which this court extended the deliberate avoidance theory, which is another permissive inference, in a guilty plea. So there has been precedent from this court. I would like to point this court to another decision. Although unpublished, it is persuasive, and it does show that the military judge did not abuse his discretion. In a guilty plea case dealing with damage of military property, but in that case, the appellant admitted that it was a natural and probable consequence that there would be damage to a garage.
Now, this is
drywall.
Lieber that you sent us yesterday, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And I assume you sent us that case yesterday because maybe you don't want to admit it, but in your mind you know that you're asking this court to go a step farther than we've ever gone, a step farther than we went in Willis, This would be a new rule to say that a military judge can resolve a conflict between what the accused said and a permissible inference by using the permissible inference to overcome it. And that would be, I think, new law. Do you agree that for us, for this court to hold that, that'd be new law?
No, Your Honor. Again, we're not asking this court to do anything different than it did in Willis.
Okay. Well, let's assume that we don't think Willis is 100% on point here, and that this would be an extension, at least, of Willis. Now, I assume you sent us Lieber because you thought, well, here, take some solace, CAF, because the Air Force CCA has already done it. Right? Was that essentially the message you were sending us with Lieber?
Your Honor, the message the government wants to send with that is that the military judge did not abuse his discretion, and that is the standard of review in this case. And so when the military judge found a plea provident and found it provident based on appellant's admissions that it was a natural and probable consequence, Lieber is instructive because it did show that the military judge did follow the applicable law. In Lieber, it cites to Johnson, this court's predecessor's opinion. And Johnson is the same underlying case in United States v. White, which is the very case that the military judge here applied and got the natural and probable consequences.
But did not Johnson, White, and Hoyt are all distinguishable because they all were contesting cases. And again, it brings us back to should that same standard be used when we have a guilty plea?
Yes, Your Honor, the same standard should be used because the military judge can draw reasonable inferences from the colloquy with the accused. And if there's a stipulation of fact, the military judge can draw, reasonable inferences from that as well. So it's consistent with this court's precedent that you can use permissive inferences. But a safeguard would be that there still has to be the factual basis for that permissive inference. And here there is a factual basis. The appellant admits to all the circumstances that the military judge relies on. And under Article 109, you can prove willful intent through circumstantial evidence. And the President's explanations does not delineate between a guilty plea and a contested case. And so when the military judge is applying circumstantial evidence, he is not abusing his discretion. He is, in fact, following the law.
Now, it could be perceived in this case that the military judge was doing his best to save this guilty plea. As you've acknowledged, we've got an accused who three times says, essentially, I did not have the intent. One of the essential elements of this offense isn't met. And the military judge then goes, let's get into reasonable inferences and so forth. Is it the role of a military judge to try to save a guilty plea, or should it be something where a military judge is less a coach and more an umpire in terms of saying, let's look at 42. A matter has been set up that's inconsistent. I am in a neutral and detached fashion going to see if the accused will acknowledge that he had the specific intent here. And if he doesn't openly, willingly acknowledge he had the specific intent, my job as the umpire is simply to say, looks like we're going to trial, unless you want to talk to your client anymore, counsel.
Your Honor, it is the military judge's duty to be the umpire in this case, to ensure that the plea is provident and that appellant knowingly waived his right to a trial of the facts.
So why doesn't it look like this is more of a coach, someone who is trying to help this plea along?
Your Honor, the military judge here was not trying to help this plea along. The military judge did his duty. He saw a red flag when appellant stated, I did not have the requisite intent. And it was at that point the military judge did his duty to follow up on any inconsistencies, because the inconsistency was contrary to the spirit of appellant's plea. Appellant pled guilty with no with no plea agreement. Appellant pled guilty because he, in fact, agreed that he was guilty. Now, given the discussion and the concerns that the military judge had about specific intent, appellant had every opportunity to withdraw from his plea, and that was not done in this case. So it gives even more credence to the fact that appellant actually understood the intent element at the end of the colloquy, and therefore he knowingly waived his right and pled guilty.
But isn't that gliding over the precedence of this court reaching back to what could be referred to as the bad old days, where there was a concern that by the very nature of the military, an accused may feel compelled to plead guilty. And so when you say he had every ability to withdraw from this plea, don't we go through all this, unlike in the civilian world, don't we go through all this, checking every box to make sure that there is no pressure? And here, when you've got an accused saying, no, essential element has not been met, and you're saying, well, he could have backed out, isn't this a bridge too far in terms of saying, well, a permissible inference can be drawn to surmount what the accused has stated directly from his or her own mouth? Isn't that ignoring the history of concerns about guilty pleas in particular in the military?
No, it's not ignoring the concerns you have, Your Honor, because in this case, the military judge ensured that appellant understood his rights by pleading guilty and waiving those rights. And at the end of the plea, the military judge ensured and asked multiple times if appellant was satisfied with his defense counsel. They took breaks to ensure whether or not appellant needed to ask any questions of his defense counsel. I mean, all the safeguards were met in this case. And when appellant stated that it was the natural and probable consequence that the destruction would occur through his voluntary act, appellant understood the intent element in this case. And for this reason, the military judge did not abuse his discretion. The plea was provident, because the circumstances and the inferences drawn therefrom in the plea colloquy all came from facts that appellant admitted to. I see that my time is up. May I briefly conclude?
First, let me check. Any more questions from the bench? Major Barris, please conclude.
The military judge did not abuse his discretion because there was a factual basis to support the plea, and therefore this court should affirm the lower court's opinion. Thank you.
Thank you. Captain Brizzi.
Members of the court, I would like to hearken to a point of discussion which came up just a little while ago. And it concerns the question of whether the inferences that the military judge drew were sufficient to overcome the inconsistency. And it's the case that that is not what happened. When we talk about specific intent, this is a matter of what's going on inside of the mind of the accused. So what's going on inside of the mind of Staff Sergeant Saul? What did he intend? And so while all these factual circumstances may or may not lend themselves to what's going on in his mind, what's unique about the Providence inquiry is that it gives the opportunity to go into his mind and to ascertain exactly what he was thinking. And he denied having had that intent. That is the inconsistency. The only way for an inconsistency of that matter to be resolved would have been to ask Staff Sergeant Saul, did you intend to destroy the windshield? And after three occasions and multiple discussion to try and overcome that, he never went back on his declaration that he did not have that intent. And so the consistency remains, and it's not resolved by the follow-up questions that the military judge asked. And so the question that the court has had before today regards this question of permissive inferences and when that can be employed. In this case, permissive inferences were not sufficient to overcome the inconsistency. More so, while there is discussion about natural and probable consequences, this is a conversation taking place looking back on things in hindsight. It's asking Staff Sergeant Saul, now that he's in court, now that he's pleading guilty, did he appreciate natural probable consequences? Well, the question that was not asked is, what was your appreciation of those natural and probable consequences on the day of the alleged offense? That's what the military judge had to get into, and he didn't do that. So we have a discussion which takes place after the fact. We have evidence, or we have admissions which rely on what is taking place within the mind of Staff Sergeant Saul. And after repeated and continual conversation, he denies that intent. And this plainly goes against Article 45. This is a situation where an inconsistent...
Just a point about what the Chief Judge raised. I mean, I understand the concerns we have about having an effective and searching guilty plea inquiry, more so than other jurisdictions for sure, but he had his counsel sitting right there, right? And his counsel, as I recall, was kind of on board with what the military judge was describing is the law with regard to intent. Was the defense counsel ineffective?
No, Your Honor. It's not our position that the defense counsel was ineffective. But importantly, the gatekeeper in this matter was the military judge. The military judge had to advise Staff Sergeant Saul as to what willfulness was, and the military judge had to resolve that inconsistency. And while defense counsel is sitting at the table and Staff Sergeant Saul has the opportunity to talk with him, this responsibility rests on the military judge, and under Article 45, he did not achieve what he was supposed to. And, Your Honors, I can see that my time is up.
Judge Sparks, is that fully responsive to your question?
Yes, that's fine.
Any other questions from the bench? Please conclude briefly.
Yes, Your Honor. And for the reasons we have provided to the Court today, we respectfully ask that this Court set aside Staff Sergeant Saul's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is now submitted. The Court thanks counsel for both sides. And the Court will stand adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.
Until tomorrow morning.